right, time for another edition, Industry 45 Podcast Show. Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Shane Christopher Neal. Thanks for hanging out. Industry 45 Podcast Show, available Giant TV Niagara on YouTube. Please subscribe there. Also, just a reminder, the quick spins, the shortened versions of the podcast are always available each week. I post them up on social media. They go on to giantfm.com, country89.com, depending the genre of the interview. Also on Facebook, the Industry 45 Podcast Show on Facebook. You can check out all the quick spins there. Again, full interviews available Giant TV Niagara on YouTube and now at musiclifemagazine.net. All right, so today from Los Angeles, California, this band, unbelievable. No record label. Complete indie band. And get this, the song you're listening to, When I'm Gone, it topped the Billboard mainstream rock song chart. The first unsigned band ever to do that. Unreal. The band's called Dirty Honey. Mark LaBelle joins me. As mentioned, from Los Angeles. He's actually from upstate New York. We'll talk a little bit about his failed hockey career as well. But the songwriting process of Dirty Honey, about this song you're listening to, When I'm Gone. They got a brand new one out called Rolling Sevens. We'll touch on that as well. And March of 2020, the band was supposed to be in Australia recording a new album. And right now they're doing some pre-production via Zoom. So we'll talk about that as well. Mark LaBelle, cool dude, great hats, cool fashion. That conversation and more coming up. Industry 45 Podcast Show.
This is the Industry 45 Podcast Show with your host, Shane Christopher Neal. Podcast available at Giant TV Niagara on YouTube.
All right, on the line, I believe all the way from Los Angeles. He's not in Australia, although I think he wishes he was. Mark LaBelle, how you doing from the band Dirty Honey?
I'd be doing better if I were in Australia, but yeah, LA is not a bad place to have to spend this time, that's for sure.
No, not at all. And we were talking before you. So you're from upstate New York. Whereabouts in upstate New York?
I am from Schenectady, New York, a little town outside of Albany.
Oh, nice, nice. And rumor has it that you are also quite a hockey player, so I hear.
Maybe not. I definitely didn't have professional aspirations. I mean, I guess I did when I was little, but yeah, certainly that would have never been a reality. So I'm glad I made the choice to pursue music when I did, because I'd still be trying to be a pro hockey player right now, and I never made it because I'm pretty small. I still love it though. I play.
You do? I was going to ask you. You still play hockey once in a while?
Yeah, and that's during quarantine. That's just sort of coming back now. I started playing again last week, and it's definitely a good way to clear your head, throughout all this. And it's the one thing that we all get to do that makes you feel normal again. So
it's funny. I look at the band picture for Dirty Honey, and I'm thinking, okay, I guess you can kind of look like a hockey player. Corey definitely looks like a hockey player. Looks like he'd play for someone like Philadelphia, maybe. Justin, not even close, because there's nobody playing hockey with hair like that. I'm sorry.
No, he looks like Troy Polamalu from the Steelers.
Absolutely. That's right. He does, actually. Okay, so before we talk about the band, two things near and dear to my heart. The first is hats, and the second are Harley Davidsons. So where do you get these epic hats, and how important is fashion today in the music business? Because you're bringing it back old school, man.
Yeah, I mean, there's two guys that I primarily buy my hats from. The first big one, they're not cheap. I have to preface that. which unfortunately I wish I was getting them for free. I'm not. but yeah, the first one is this guy, Brandon Wise. They're both, oddly enough, both these guys are like within a mile of each other. But he's right in Venice, California. And the other guy is a guy called Nick Bouquet, who is a little bit more well-known, I guess, for his hats, but he's also in Venice right down the road, and they're competing like hatters that I just, you know, grew up. I discovered them both at different times and love both their work, and they've been nice enough to make stuff for me.
So how important is it though, like for fashion? Because I'm big on the look, and I know that, you know, obviously you're a fan of Steven Tyler and Aerosmith, and I mean, just that, yeah, that whole vibe. How important is that as a front guy for you today?
Yeah, I mean, it's always, I love the era of rock stars that looked like rock stars, you know. And that's not to say that I didn't love, you know, like Soundgarden and Pearl Jam and Nirvana, where they sort of more looked like the roadies of the day than you know, like a David Lee Roth showboat sort of personality. And I think the middle ground for me is more like the Robert Plant, Steven Tyler type front man, you know, with in terms of their fashion. That's sort of what I like to channel, that just that idea. It's a little less, it's definitely not 80s, but it's kind of a subdued cool, like, you know, they got a look that's kind of unique to their own, and I think that is important, you know. I love all that stuff, and I love fashion, and I love hats, obviously, so you know, it's definitely a big part of my, you know, personality.
It's funny because before I ever heard Dirty Honey play anything, I saw a photo and then I saw a video, and to me, who's 51, the first thing that captured me was the presence of the band. Now the band is epic, so that's a bonus, but it definitely was something that captured me, and just the look that you guys had. And but let's move on from that to the music, because that's what's really important here. So tell me, I don't, you know, the beginning of this band obviously wasn't that long ago, but I'm sure you've learned a lot in a short period of time. What are some of the lessons, though, over the past few years that you could pass on to somebody? This is kind of a music industry show, so, and you guys have done so well for an indie band.
Sure.
Maybe what are some of those lessons?
I think, you know, it's funny that you're just saying that you used to do a lot of stuff with rock and roll and country, and I heard Chris Stapleton, you know, talking on Howard Stern about how there's nothing that can replace the hard work that he's put into with songwriting. And he would literally just be at his office in Nashville trying to collaborate with other songwriters, and he would try and crank out a couple songs a day, you know, at one point in his life. And, you know, when you put in that work, there's nothing else that can really replace it. And, you know, that's obviously a huge piece of the puzzle. And hard work, not only with songwriting, but trying to get your name out there and promotion, you have to do all that stuff yourself, especially early on. And yeah, there's really no replacement for just good old fashioned hard work. And obviously you have to have talent to go along with it, and you have to have something that's unique, or, you know, filling some sort of musical void in the musical landscape of the time. You know, and all those things kind of come together and create success, and you got to be lucky as well. And you know, but the one thing, it sounds like a cliche, but it's got to work really hard. And, you know, people don't really hear about our struggle early on or anything like that. And, you know, some people might look at us and see an overnight success when really it was, you know, a couple of years in the making.
Sure.
Getting to this point.
So, on the songwriting side of it, you've got some really catchy tunes, and I was watching something on YouTube, you're playing acoustically, and it came to my thought that, do you write songs acoustically and then turn them into, you know, the electric version, or do you just write them as the electric version, and when you have to dummy them down, you do that? Because there's different ways to write songs, right? What's your process?
Yeah, it's kind of a case-by-case basis, right? If, like When I'm Gone, for instance, that was just a riff that came to us with, you know, in an electric atmosphere, not, you know, wasn't an acoustic thing. And you know, from the moment I heard that riff, I was like, wow, it's a great riff, you know, and now we got to build around it somehow. And that honestly took a couple years to really dial that into what it became. There were different choruses at one point, different lyrics. I mean, that song had a whole different meaning. But then like something like Down the Road, you know, that was an acoustic thing that I drummed up. You know, it's kind of strummy and, you know, you can kind of hear where the catalyst of that was with an acoustic guitar. You know, and then other times, you know, you just write something in the room with everybody where it just all happens in, you know, the course of an hour. And all of a sudden you have a song like Rolling Sevens that, you know, just came out of nowhere one day. But yeah, the one that probably took the most work was Heartbreaker. I think we wrote a couple of different variations of that song. Justin had this riff and we would play it acoustic. We would play it electric and it never really seemed to work until we got the tempo right. And then, a couple nights before I went to Australia, I rewrote the whole thing, all the melodies and lyrics. And, I still have a voice memo where I sort of caught on to what the chorus is now. And I was like, I think that's pretty good. And I say it in the memo. And it's fun now to think back in that time and, you know, go to a show and hear, you know, 1,000 people or whatever singing the chorus to that song that, you know, I just drummed up in my room alone one night at like 4 a.m. You know, it's a pretty cool thing. But again, it goes back to the hard work. You know, it was not an easy road coming up with what that song became.
How important is it too to keep all the different pieces that you're writing for songs? Because I've heard you say too that, you know, you write some things and they may not fit for this song, or the melody might not work, or that particular part of the guitar you're playing might not, but you keep them around because you never know when you might have to use them somewhere else, right?
Oh, totally. I mean, there's riffs that have been around for years that, you know, are great and they just haven't had the other pieces of the puzzle, you know, come together. You know, and when I'm gone, that was the chorus, all I wanted to say, that was another chorus from another completely different song that was very like Black Crowes-y that we had. And it was in a different key. And I remember saying to John one day, I was like, I'm thinking about taking this section from this song and throwing it on to When I'm Gone. What do you think? And he's like, that sounds great. And you know, that happens a lot. You know, you have all these, you know, when you have great starts and, you know, you can start figuring out this little map, musical map, and put things together that start to make sense. And it's a long, arduous process. So I'll tell you.
So when you started, was your goal to capture a record deal? I mean, you're in Los Angeles, and you've got some great songs. And When I'm Gone, obviously a top Billboard mainstream rock, unbelievable. I think that's the first time an unsigned band had ever done that. Were you searching for a record deal? And are you still, or does it really matter to you at this point? Because let's face it, you've been on big tours, big festivals. You're getting radio play. Eddie Trunk loves you. You've got everything going in the right direction.
Eddie Trunk is the man. I love Eddie.
Everything's going in the right direction, you know, and you don't have a record label.
No, we don't. And, you know, it was important. Probably when I first moved out to LA, that was still sort of the thing to do. And then, you know, our manager played a big part in that, he ran labels. He ran Capitol Records. And I always say that the people that were at labels that were really smart got out of the label business, right?
Absolutely.
They moved to management, or they moved over to Live Nation or something. They saw the trends, and you want somebody in your corner that's able to, you know, sort of see the future of the business and where the business is trending towards. And, you know, he's definitely that guy, and he's an unbelievable marketing line. And when we started getting record deal offers, and there were plenty of them, you know, he would look at them with us and he'd go, what do you guys want to do? Like, I just don't think this really makes sense to do. You're going to lose a lot of creative control. You're going to, you know, why would we do this? What do we need this for? You got me. He's like, I ran labels for years and nobody knows how to run a record label better than me. So, why don't I just do it? So, like, hell yeah. Man. I love.
So you're talking about Mark here, correct?
Yes. Yep.
And is it his brother, Nick? Who's your producer?
His brother's Nick, who is the producer, yeah.
Right, out in Australia. So he did your first EP and apparently was going to do the second album this March, but it hasn't happened yet. Although I do see that you guys have done some pre-production via Zoom with him. And what's the status right now of Dirty Honey and new music?
Yeah, we're doing some pre-production stuff right now, which wasn't too dissimilar to how we did pre-production before we went to Australia the first time. So it's not that different. It's just there's a little bit of uncertainty right now as to like when we're going to be able to get into a studio, hopefully with Nick in person, because that's really an ingredient that you can't get around. We all want to have that person in the room with us, you know, so that's really the big question mark at this point. And obviously, yeah, we were supposed to be there in March and that didn't happen. So it's very frustrating, but the quarantine has given us a lot of time to work on songs and it's ultimately going to make a better record. There's no doubt about it.
And become a better hockey player too. So what is Nick? I mean, I'm sure Nick has taught you a lot, but if you had to pick something specific, one or two things that he has done for your band to really catapult them, what would it be? Just his attitude, the way he works with you, how he changes stuff, what he gets out of you. Like, what has he done to help you guys along?
Yeah, he's really a master in knowing when to like kick you out of the studio, like when your job is done, when you're, you know, oftentimes, especially nowadays, it's so easy to edit yourself on a computer that, you know, he's got a really good ear and making sure you don't over edit yourself or over perfect your, you know, performance that you lay down. So that, you know, it still captures that live feel that, you know, you're going for as a rock and roll band. You know, all those great bands that I loved growing up, they captured performances in a room. And Joe Walsh has a famous quote where he said, if we had Pro Tools back when we recorded Hotel California, we'd still be recording Hotel California today. And I'm like, yeah, it's so true. You can totally go too far down that rabbit hole. So he's great with that sense and just knowing, like, when you're done, get out of the room. You know, you did it. Stop thinking about it too much, you know. And he understands nuance really well. Just he was great with me and telling me like how long to scream, you know, at one point, or when to lay the rasp on in my voice, or when to like sit back on things a little bit more and give it a little more like R&B feel. And he can articulate those things, but you know exactly what he's saying. And, you know, it really helps. It really helps capture these subtle things that make a big difference in the recording.
I've heard you say a few times, performance over perfection. And I agree. And I could tell when I see you guys play, when I watch live video, that you're a live band. You're like a, and I say that about Aerosmith and you mentioned the Eagles and so many others, the Rolling Stones, like those to me are performing bands you need to see live. So damn it, we need to see you live. We need to get through all this so you can come totally to Canada and play. Last thing we'll talk about, because I know you're a busy guy.
We were supposed to be up there in the spring, man.
Well, see, we need to make this happen soon. Rolling Sevens, let's talk about that finally. So that's the new song that's out. Maybe talk a little bit about the writing of that song. And the video is pretty cool, too.
Yeah, so we, that was the tune on the record that, you know, John had this sort of opening riff that I thought was really cool. And I just kept pressuring him to play it. And let's all play it together, you know, whatever. And I didn't really have any lyrics for the song until we went to Australia. We just had this music and I knew I was going to be sort of singing along with the riff during the chorus and didn't really know what I was going to be saying though. It was very Steven Tyler what I was doing when I would get to the chorus and it'd just be like, you know, yeah, that's whatever. And it didn't make any sense. We just knew it sounded cool. yeah, and I was alone in my room in Australia, like we're getting ready to track vocals to this song. And I've got nothing, and I sit down, and I somehow hit on, you know, the phrase, I'm rolling sevens again, and looked up exactly, I knew it was a gambling reference, obviously, but looked up exactly what it meant, and then there's some alternative meanings, but in the urban dictionaries, that just were too good to be true for a sexy rock and roll song, and I just fell into these lyrics that I really screwed up to love, and So, you know, when we listened back to that one in the studio, it was a pretty magical moment. We all sort of looked at each other like, wow, I can't believe that. It was pretty crazy. Yeah, and then we shot this video with go ahead.
No, go ahead with the video. Yeah, it was a great video.
Yeah, we went ahead with this video idea that myself and my director friend Scott had come up with. And whenever John would play that riff, I just sort of saw a chick on a motorcycle, you know, riding through the desert or something. And that was the only visual I have. But I always sort of saw that, and I pitched it to my buddy Scott, and he was like, I think I can, you know, fill in the rest of the story. Let's make it, you know, sort of like the early days of Dirty Honey playing in a club in LA. And I was like, okay, yeah, cool. That sounds cool. And he sort of just filled it in with things that would actually happen at our shows, like fights and stuff. And, you know, he did a great, great, great job shooting it in one take and making it very Martin Scorsese. So, he did a great job executing that. And, he's a great friend, and he's been with us since the beginning, going to shows and stuff. So he knows what we're about.
That's awesome. Okay. One other question, Nell, I just thought of this is, are you feeling, like there's a lot of pressure though on the next album to come out? You've got some great songs. You have a number one song from this, Rolling Sevens is kicking ass. Like, is there part of you that is kind of going, we need to really, you know, step up here because you know what can happen, right? I mean, you could put out something that isn't going to compete with what you've got out there right now. And, that's always something tough, right? With number two.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, that's definitely, it was a concern. With the first gig on the Rolling Sevens tour was in Austin, Texas. And we played this song, called The Wire, and our manager was there and his two daughters were there. And this, you know, it was a song that literally nobody had heard before, that show. And like, you know, we would hang out and sell merch after the show, and people would come up to us and be like, "That fuck, you know, The Wire, man, like that song's awesome. I can't wait to hear that one on the record." And right away people responded to it, and definitely took some of the pressure off the next thing, knowing that, you know, people already really like it and they're hitting me up every day, like, when are we gonna get a recorded version of The Wire? So I'm pretty happy that it's gotten some good feedback already, but yeah, the pressure's on more than anything just to get something out. People are like dying for us to put something new out because it's been so long, and now we're even delayed even more with COVID stopping things the way it did. It's a little frustrating, but you know, I promise once we get something out, I think people are gonna really enjoy it. I'm very happy with the way the writing's gone through this thing.
Well, that's awesome. I'm looking forward to it too. You guys sound great. You're a lot of fun. Just, you're a lot of fun to talk to, and just seeing your videos and all that stuff online. I really hope to see you sometime in 2020 would be nice here in Canada. DirtyHoney.com is the website. Mark LaBelle, thank you so much for your time, sir.
Thanks for listening to the Industry 45 podcast show. Check out all podcasts at GiantTV.ca, GiantFM.com, Country89.com, and Giant TV Niagara on YouTube.